Hey, this is Melissa Parsons, and you are listening to the Your Favorite You podcast. I'm a certified life coach with an advanced certification in deep dive coaching. The purpose of this podcast is to help brilliant women like you with beautiful brains create the life you've been dreaming of with intention. My goal is to help you find your favorite version of you by teaching you how to treat yourself as your own best friend. If this sounds incredible to you and you want practical tips on changing up how you treat yourself, then you're in the right place. Just so you know, I'm a huge fan of using all of the words available to me in the English language, so please proceed with caution if young ears are around.
Well, hey you.
Hey girl, hey.
How are you doing?
I'm amazing. How are you?
Good. How's the husband?
Oh, he's doing so good. He's better, and he was really sick there for a while, and it was not fun.
Yeah, that's scary.
So yeah, I mean, it was to the point where he doesn't get scared by much, but when he was like, "I'm worried that this is something other than just like we thought it was viral crud and that type of thing," but we were very, very happy that his sinuses were filled with snot. And that is his poor lower lobes of his lungs were clogged because it could have been a lot worse, as you know.
It's funny how much relative goes into being sick, right?
Yes. Yeah. The relativity was real. It was real.
You look fabulous.
Thank you. So do you.
Well, I thank you. So I'll accept it first, and then I will say that this week has been my week for the first week where I'm not either just back from travel or heading out to travel in 3 months.
Wow.
And last year was a lot of that too.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling a little disoriented, and you're getting me in my flannels and jeans. And
I love it. I'm in my quiet sweatshirt.
Yeah, my quiet upstairs office rather than in something that looks a little nicer. But I figured you wanted the real me, so here you got it.
Oh, girl, always. Yeah, I want, you know, my podcast is called Your Favorite You. So my favorite me wears jeans and sweatshirts and is cozy and like has a blanket and has her tea and all the things. So and awesome. Swears a bunch.
Yeah. Do we get to swear on the podcast? I mean, already recording. So I just want to fucking make sure before we get too far in.
It has an explicit warning. And at the intro, I say something like, I like to use all of the words available to me in the English language. So if young ears are around, please proceed with caution. And my family's from my pediatric office know. They're like, oh yeah, the kids are going to learn nice some warning. New words today.
That's a nice warning. They're not learning anything new. If they tell you they are, they're lying to your face.
Well, I mean, they were pretty little.
Oh, okay.
I didn't care how old they were. I just started swearing right out.
Oh yeah. At one point, I think my husband, bless, said, when we had Joseph, we really need to stop swearing. I said, why the fuck would we do that? Only thing I want to make sure is that he knows how to do it well.
Exactly.
That's the travesty. If you're going to use the words with me, you better know how to use it well, creatively, and never at someone. Next to someone's okay, but never at someone.
That's amazing. When I have Jack, who's 20, he'll be 22 next month, and Owen, who just turned 19. And when Owen was about, he must have been like 18 months old, because he was in the grocery cart, you know, in the thing, and Jack was walking beside me. So Jack was probably 4 and a half, and Owen was 1 and a half. And we're walking along, and Owen drops something. We're in the paper aisle, you know, and Owen drops something, and he goes, God damn it. And I was like, what did you say? And of course, he repeated
it. He says, are you fucking deaf? I said, God damn it.
Exactly.
That's what you get from mine.
Exactly. And Jack goes, Mom, is he allowed to say that? I was like, I think so.
Don't ask me. I'm making this shit up as I go along.
Well, yeah. So I'm just going to like do a soft intro because we've already done the intro. They're getting to see exactly who we are. So I'm just going to go ahead and welcome everybody back to Your Favorite You and tell everyone how honored and delighted I am to be joined by you today. This amazing woman is another amazing physician coach, and all of you loyal listeners have already heard about her because you listened to my podcast episode number 13, Being a Beginner Sucks. And I raved about Dr. Seraph at the beginning of that podcast. So Dr. Kemia Seraph is a badass whose two plus decade career has included becoming both an MD and a Master of Public Health. She has worn multiple hats and I'm sure continues to wear multiple hats throughout her illustrious career, including and likely not limited to being the owner of a medical practice in internal medicine. She is a public health program developer. She is involved in nonprofit leadership. She owns businesses. She's held multiple board positions. And I found her because she does much needed trauma mitigation work. And she's also a farmer in her spare time. Dr. K, I think you still like to be called, correct? Founded Lodestar.
It seems to be easiest yeah, exactly. for everybody.
She founded Lodestar, specializing in trauma responsive coaching for physicians, which we all need as docs. And I attended her day-long trauma responsive coaching and leadership workshop in November of 2022. And I've been a fan of hers even before then. So what else, what am I missing, Kemia? What else do my listeners need to know about you?
Well, I'll offer two things. I'll offer two things right out of the gate. So thank you, first of all. Second of all, probably I would say those are the least interesting things about me, maybe with the exception of being a farmer. I'll make small corrections. One, I did not own my own internal medicine practice. You mentioned that. I hope that's not
I made it up.
In the universe. I did patient. Oh, okay. I mean, that would be badass, right? Like if I was to look at what else might I want to do, owning my own medical practice might be pretty far up there. I think it's time for doctors to get back in the business of owning how they practice medicine. Yeah. We can come back to that later. And Dr. K. So it's such an interesting thing because it was picked up as a sort of an honorary title. When I was a young resident, a young attending, I can't remember who first said it, but it kind of stuck and it made it so much easier for everyone. Because my name is a challenge, Kemia, which is how it's how my daddy would pronounce it. Let's put it that way. Kemia is just not a name you hear anywhere. And so what I have come to really understand is that when I give people lots and lots of latitude to call me what is easy for them, it's just one less thing that they have to think about in the back of their head. And I think that that is a great starting point when we start talking about the cognitive load and stress and where our energies are being directed.
I love it. Well, thank you so much.
I also have four semi-feral sons. It's always important to say that because I bred my own farmhands and I am married to an interventional cardiologist that I met while I was in medical school. He was my resident. He was my senior resident. So yes, we were that couple. And here we are 25 years
Congratulations.
Later.
I know. Cause I am also 25 years into my multi-physician household marriage. So yeah, it's not for the weak.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast and for agreeing to share your, you know, vast knowledge and your beautiful personality. So, which I think you're already showing everybody. So, okay. In this participant guide that you gave us that we received in our training day, there's a quote
All right, we're going straight there.
And I'm not sure if it's yours, but I want to explore it a bit. And it says, the idea that we can be immersed in suffering and loss and not be harmed is as unrealistic as expecting to walk through water without getting wet.
Yeah, that's Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen. She wrote one of many books that she's written that I read in medical school. I think the title of it is Kitchen Table Wisdom. I could be misattributing the title. So, you know, we'll Google before we, before we go too far. Very, very, very wise, thoughtful, empathic physician. And the things that I have read of hers and learned from her over what is now, I am now a PGY25. I calculated that the
That's
other day.
Amazing.
Holy shamoly, right? I have been reading and learning from her for a very, very long time. And I think that is, it's a really important noticing. And it becomes really, really important when we begin stepping towards the idea that there is a cost. There is a price to be paid for the work we do. And that's not a bad thing, right? That isn't to say, oh, you know, we're all paying this really heavy price. We should opt out, or we should do it differently, or we should armor up more, or we should do any of those things. I think where the cost becomes compounded is when we don't name it as such and plan for it, right? So if you know, I mean, let's take it out of the realm, this sort of existential realm, and let's take it over into like our own budgets, right? If you know that you are going to have these expenses coming up later in the month, you're going to plan for them, right? We understand this when it comes to monetary budgets. We have to begin to think and plan for this when it comes to the body budget, right? The energy budget really is what I'm talking about when I say that, because everything has, there's a price, there's a cost associated with these things. And we have to decide what we're willing, what's a reasonable, appropriate price to pay. Now, I happen to be one of those odd ducklings who still adore our profession. I adore my colleagues. I love my medical students. They're just so squishy. I love residents. I love grouchy old attendings who used to scare me to death. I love the idea, not necessarily the execution all the time. I love the idea of the healing profession. It is honorable. And it is, I think, for most of us, when we go in, a calling.
Yeah.
Not a job, not a profession, not a career. It's calling.
For sure. For those of you who are listening who aren't physicians, PGY stands for postgraduate year. So that means that 25 years ago,
I graduated from medical school.
I'm even doing it.
You got it. There you got it. That's why Dr. K's easier.
That is easier. Yeah.
Or hey, you. Or yo, lady.
graduated from medical school. So about the same time I did. And I don't know about you, but I knew I wanted to help people. I guess I didn't know how much trauma would be sustained in doing that. And I think the idea, like you say, of naming it and planning for it instead of pretending that it's not happening and just going on about life, pretending and just going to the next room, you know, that is the key.
I think it's achy. And the cross fingers, I don't know if you remember, but I cross my fingers when something comes up that I don't want to forget because I don't take notes. Terrible. I think two things you said there really struck me. The first is I went into this profession and I've only in recent years been able to name this without feeling mm-hmm. pokey. I went into it because mm-hmm. I wanted to heal people. There are a lot of ways, a lot of professions that you and I could have gone into mm-hmm. where we could help people. It's become really important for me to give the name of the ideal anyway, which is of healing, which encompasses a lot more than just mm-hmm. curing. Mm-hmm. Right. Or treating. I think it's a bigger, more expansive, more complete, less easily defined mm-hmm. description. And I think it's okay to begin to play with that idea and that terminology because we are in the mm-hmm. healing professions. Right. So that one leads me to point two, which is, I think it's really important that we understand what Dr. Raymond was pointing to when she said that the idea that we can be immersed in this and not mm-hmm. harmed or mm-hmm. not impacted, not affected. And I think we're supposed to be. Look, we've got these brilliant, beautiful, wonderful, incredibly lazy brains. We'll talk about the lazy brain later. Brains that have evolved with this gorgeous limbic resonance, right? This thing in my brain that when you're smiling and you're leaning forward and your energy goes up, it gives me a little spark mm-hmm. that makes me want to do the same, right? Limbic resonance is mm-hmm. how we connect. It's how we share joy, right? It's also how we co-recognize and share threat mm-hmm. or danger, right? It's also sort of the dark side of that is that it makes us susceptible to vicarious mm-hmm. and secondary trauma, meaning that when we begin to think about trauma more broadly, not just as a single event in time that happens to me, but rather as those, even those smaller ruptures that occur mm-hmm. that cause harm, right? And that can be compounded over time, right? When I am spending my days immersed in the suffering of colleagues, patients, clients, community, family, those who I walk alongside, mm-hmm. that I journey with, sometimes that I have direct responsibility for, right? And their traumas, the limbic resonance that is generated between us leaves an impact. And for anyone who might be quirking an eyebrow around the idea that secondary and vicarious trauma are every bit as real and every bit as impactful, and frankly, phenotypically, when it starts showing up in a patient or a client, I can't differentiate between primary and secondary or vicarious trauma.
Right. It
looks exactly the same, right? So we can turn back to mm-hmm. the ACEs study, right? So my pediatrician friends are always the ones who know this, right? The Adverse Childhood Experiences study, enormous study, groundbreaking study in that it had an enormous N, right? 17,500 respondents to the survey. It was quite elegant in its simplicity. It was 10 questions. I call them, sometimes refer to them as the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. Is it complete? Absolutely not. Nobody would joke about that or pretend that it is. And, right, it was the first enormous data collection of its kind that I know of anyway, that gave us hard numbers to back up what we had long observed.
Anecdotally
right?
seen. Yeah.
Which is that, right? That trauma sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Probably a lot of your listeners have heard the book title, The Body Keeps the Score.
Yes.
Right? Trauma, especially those traumas experienced in childhood and any traumas that we experience that are not appropriately disrupted or mitigated, they stay in us. There is an embodied experience that we have. So let's just look at that study, right? Because we have this tendency to dismiss or diminish the idea that secondary trauma, listening to it, being immersed in it, vicarious trauma, that stuff we invite in through our television screens and our TikTok and our Twitter feed and our, you know, our news cycle, mm-hmm. that those impact us in the same way. And yet even the original study, when you go back and you read the questions, do you remember how the questions are worded?
No.
Children who before their 18th birthday experience or witness. Experience or witness.
Wow.
Even the original study is looking at the impact of bearing witness to harm done to others.
Mm-hmm. Secondary trauma.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Vicarious yeah. as well. Yeah. Right. And so I think that we have to begin to develop an awareness of, not because I'm going to stop being who I am mm-hmm. or stop caring for who I care about or stop bearing witness even to things that are happening in the world. Mm-hmm. Right. My ethic demands that of me.
Right.
What I am going to begin to do is understand there is a cost associated mm-hmm. and I am going to plan for that expense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to know what disrupts it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to know what increases my body budget over here so that I can pay that price
mm-hmm.
without harming myself further.
Right.
Right.
Or the people that you care about. By carrying
or
the
people. Oh my goodness. Exactly. But we can't do any of that, mm-hmm. right? If we don't know there's a budget mm-hmm. to be managed and we don't know those things that make it worse mm-hmm. and those things
that
are
better.
Wonderful mitigators and disruptors.
Mm-hmm. I mean, can you just I don't think that my audience probably knows the difference between what we call big T trauma versus little T trauma. Would you mind talking about that a little bit?
Yeah. And I'm going to translate my face or my silence, depending on how people are consuming this right now.
Both ways.
Yeah. I'm not sure. And I've used the term before, big
yeah,
T, little T.
Yeah, I don't love it either.
I'm not sure we're doing ourselves or anyone else any favor. So let's just say that and then set it down.
Right.
Because here's what we do know, right? You and I can be, here we are, you know, roughly the same age, although you look about 10 years younger. And, you know, approximately the same, you know, time of graduation, same era, you mm-hmm. know, we're I'm assuming we are both Gen Xers and, you know,
yes.
so there's some relative similarities.
Except I only have two feral boys. You have four. That might be the difference.
I just mean I didn't learn my lesson the first couple times. kidding, Joshua, Jonah, I'm just kidding. I would say that. So, you know, here we are relatively similar in some, you know, in some major ways, mm-hmm. right? About the same age, about the same stage, both physicians. You know, we both like to cuss a lot. We're both pretty sturdy, I think, overall. You know, we have pretty sturdy sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I could be standing exactly together and have the exact same experience, mm-hmm. traumatic or non-traumatic, doesn't, but like this, the exact same huge, overwhelming experience. Mm-hmm. And after it's done, we might turn and look at each other and I might say, oh my God, that was so horrible. I just feel shattered. Mm-hmm. And you might look at me and be like, the fuck is your problem? That was nothing. Mm-hmm. Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. It was a nothing sandwich, Kimia. Mm-hmm. Move along. Mm-hmm. Okay. Why is this important? It's really important because trauma is subjective. Mm-hmm. Trauma is subjective. Dr. Gabor Mate teaches us that trauma is not what happens to us. So same event, same thing, you and me, right? It's not what happens to us. It's what happens inside as a result of mm-hmm. what happened to us, mm-hmm. right? So, and that, my friend, is contingent upon a lot of things, mm-hmm. right? So what could have been different between you and me that made this land as trauma for me and as a nothing sandwich for you, mm-hmm. right? Well, I may have previous experiences and exposure mm-hmm. that caused that moment in time to activate my nervous system differently, mm-hmm. made it appear to be an enormous threat to me. When for you, it was like,
yeah, this happens all the day, every day. Yeah.
Right. Right. Or, you know, it was interesting, but it wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. So our previous experiences, mm-hmm. right? You may be very well resourced or well resourced in ways I'm not. Mm-hmm. Right? You may have know that you have access to, let's just say you have a robust bank account. Mm-hmm. You have great savings, you have great health insurance. Mm-hmm. And I, on the other hand, am like, this is the thing that's gonna I can't pay my bills now this month. Right? So resourcing mm-hmm. matters a lot, mm-hmm. right? Another example, you may be having that, we may be having that exposure or that experience at the same moment in time. And for you, you're coming off of, you know, 3 weeks of regular schedule and good sleep. And I may have just spent the last month on the front lines in 2020 in New York, mm-hmm. in an ER with COVID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally different.
Right? And so my resources may be very depleted mm-hmm. because I am exhausted and overwhelmed mm-hmm. and, mm-hmm. right? So trauma is subjective mm-hmm. and there's no trauma Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? You could hold very gracefully space for the fact that that landed as traumatic for me mm-hmm. without needing to do comparison, mm-hmm. without saying, well, what if, or it could have been so much worse, or, oh, well, I know exactly what you're saying because I had this experience. And then we're in some sort of comparison thing about whose pain is worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many people want to do that.
Yes. And I think we do it for two reasons. I think we first reach for it because it is actually a way of connecting, yeah, right? You've heard me say same, same, same,
yeah.
right? So same, same, same is like how we lean in mm-hmm. and capitalize on that limbic resonance. We want to draw closer. We want to, right? I think the advanced skill is recognizing that same, same, same is very applicable in some instances mm-hmm. and when the person sitting with us revealing a story or talking to us about something is in a state of activation, mm-hmm. same, same, same lands as dismissive, diminishing, decentering, yeah. you know, and so that's the moment to just hold their pain, even if your pain is bigger, mm-hmm. right? Your story is bigger. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You're not the center of the story in this moment. Mm-hmm. And this becomes really, really challenging.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about mitigating trauma. Like, what are the ways that you feel are most effective for the vast majority of people, or is it totally person specific?
Mm. The good news, if it were person specific, we'd be in trouble, wouldn't we? We really need broadly applicable tools for this. Yeah. And so this concept of becoming trauma responsive and how we engage with each other, I think becomes really important. And it's what I like to refer to as inside out work. Mm-hmm. You know, it begins with my understanding neurobiologically what's happening, mm-hmm. right? And that we can actually distill into some non-medicified, some, you know, we can take the neuroscience and we can distill it down into something that anybody can grasp.
Yeah.
Right. We're hardwired for threat. Mm-hmm. That's a graspable concept. Mm-hmm. We evolved with this amazing threat detection system mm-hmm. that is designed to do one thing and one thing only, and that is keep us alive long enough so that we can breed feral children. Right. And so that system is incredibly sensitive. Mm-hmm. And when we're exposed to chronic toxic levels of stress, unrelenting toxic stress, the signals begin to get mixed up, mm-hmm. right? The system becomes more and more sensitized. It becomes primed to react, mm-hmm. Which is why it's important that we begin to notice, right, when the system is getting primed. Mm-hmm. When the toxic stress has been too much for too long and begin disrupting for ourselves. If we can't learn to do this for ourselves, mm-hmm. then our capacity to recognize it in someone else is always going to be hindered.
Right. Yeah. It explains why, you know, you lose your shit on your 4-year-old for putting their shoes on wrong when it really doesn't matter. But you've got all this other stuff. It's never about the shoes or the dishwasher or any of the things, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Cumulative and compounding, which is why coming full circle, I think it's good for us to start to move away from the big T, little T. Mm-hmm. I don't think we need to quantify it. Mm-hmm. And for those, and there are many among us, physicians in particular, frankly, who shy away from the idea of even having experienced trauma, mm-hmm. that's okay too, mm-hmm. right? I sometimes it's easier to just acknowledge that we're all the walking wounded.
Yeah.
Every one of us is carrying places of harm. Mm-hmm. Every single person, just like me, mm-hmm. not different than me, right? Not I'm better because I have fewer, or I'm worse because I have more. Just we all. And when we begin to lean into that as a universality, as a universal truth, then we don't have to parse it anymore. And we don't have to quantify it. We simply have to acknowledge it. And then we can begin to don universal precautions, mm-hmm. right? So we can skill ourselves in an approach that allows us to recognize those early signals that someone's threat detection system is being activated. We can also learn to really understand and appreciate that evolutionarily, it was just as dangerous to be excluded from your community as it was to engage with the saber-toothed tiger. Mm-hmm. And so our threat detection system reads those two things the same.
Right.
It's looking for, scanning for exclusion threat, social threat, mm-hmm. just as actively as it is scanning and looking for physical threat. Yeah. And it'll react the same way. It doesn't differentiate. And this is true for every single person. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
that
so funny.
Evolutionary hardwiring. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just talking to one of my clients who happens to also be a pediatrician, and she's the mom of the 4-year-old with the shoes, where I'm like, it's not about the shoes. And, you know, she has this perception, and I think we all had it at some point, and many of us have maybe outgrown it, that, you know, if our kids can be put on this persona of being perfect, somehow it reflects back on us as mothers that we are perfect, and that will keep us in the social circle. So like, this is just like, this coaching just happened yesterday, so it's fresh in my mind. So I'm like, this makes so much sense.
Oh, bless. You know, it's interesting. There's some really, really good data out there that show us that the opposite of belonging is actually fitting in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really cognitively expensive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to feel wanted and needed and appreciated and like you belong, that's one thing. To be scanning the room for those cues that tell you, if you act this way, you do this thing, you whatever, the whatevering, right? Then you'll fit. That's a really, really taxing, cognitively expensive space to operate out of. And yes, to your point, it's totally normal. Young mamas, I mean, I'm sure you can remember this. I can remember it in my bone, like feeling like there was a right way to do the things so that my child would have total ease and acceptance, and that there's some that somehow reflects on me as a parent.
So much compassion.
Yeah. And I got my ass kicked on that one pretty early. I'm not for everyone. I've never been for everyone. And
me neither, girl. Cheers to that.
Well, I'm not sure that any of us are really.
And, no, because then we'd be trying to fit in.
Yes.
Who needs that?
It's cognitively expensive, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the learning, and I think, you know, we don't talk enough about the normal stages of adult development. Y'all pediatricians, you're really good with the normal stages of child development, but there are normal, healthy, predictable stages of adult development. And I can tell you that as a, you know, as a coach, as a, you know, as a medical educator, or as a lot of different things, just as a friend now, I can usually guess someone's age at this point by what they're concerned about. Not by how old their children are, not by, right, but like, what are the things that they are thinking about as they try to make sense of the world? Where is their locus of focus, right? It's fairly predictable, and we all go through it, you know, and the shorthand sometimes, and I think you and I were joking about this back in Texas, that 40s are where your fucks fly away. I mean, I loved my 40s. I loved. They're in the rearview mirror. They're in the rearview mirror for me now. And right, it really wasn't so much that. What it was, as I look back on that decade, it was the clarity I began to develop around who I was when I was dead center in my integrity. Who is that person? How does she show up? What does she, how does she move in the world? And when you begin to really get curious about those things and move into that space, and it's a cognitively heavy space too, right? I think Brene Brown talks about midlife is when, how she says it. I'm going to butcher the quote, but she says midlife is when the universe takes you by the shoulders, leans in really close, and says, I'm not fucking around anymore.
Yeah, so good.
All of this stuff you're doing to pretend to be, to right, it's preventing your growth. And there's a cost to that too. So
yeah.
I think that the beauty of our 40s can be an increased spaciousness to begin to explore our own becoming. And it's painful.
Yeah.
And beautiful and normal.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite things to help women with, right? I mean, that is why my podcast is called Your Favorite You. It's why my group program is called Your Favorite You. It's like, let's figure out what your favorite version of yourself does, how she acts, you know, how she dresses, how much she curses, you know, all the things, right? And like, let's live into that and like see that we don't have to pretend anymore. We don't have to try to fit in. One of the first things I teach in my group is belonging and like teaching women to belong to themselves first, which a lot of people are like, what the fuck are you even talking about? And, you know, so I have to explain it to them, which is fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you start to really belong to yourself and can live in integrity and can look in the mirror at night and be like, I did the best I could today. Like, I gave it everything that I've got. I don't have to do anything more.
Or I didn't.
People.
I'm going to give you that. Yeah. Or I didn't. I did not give it everything I got today. I sat on my couch and I ate some fucking bonbons and was really bad at some things.
Yes.
I never
That's
worry.
True too, girl.
I never worry. You know, I think it's women physicians are a funny bunch. Man, we're screwed up, but we are a funny bunch because I never worry that our colleagues are going to not strive. But I think that the hidden fear, the paper dragon that so many of us carry is if I slow down or God forbid I stop. I'll never get going again.
Yeah.
I think that's the hidden.
Will just keep me in space.
Right? Like that, like if I'm going to somehow dissolve from structure to soup.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just nothing further from the truth. I also, this is my big pitch, right? You were talking about, what did you open with? Hard things, new things, something. You had a phrase you used. You said your podcast number 13 was about...
Oh, being a beginner sucks.
Being a beginner sucks.
I was telling them about the beginner you.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's my both and to that too. You know me, I got a both and for everything.
I know you do. Give it to me.
For the love of God, can we for our own sakes and we for the sakes of our children, for the sake of the children, okay, never mind you, at least for the sake of the children who we are harming. We collectively, the parents, the elders, the grownups in the fucking room are harming our children because we are not encouraging them to go be bad at things. Please, for the love of God, if you're going to do anything for your children, encourage them to go be bad at a whole lot of things and have a glorious, messy, filthy, roll in the dirt. Screw it up, jam on the face, never going to be good at it and going to do it anyway. Time
Playing
of
the
it.
Guitar. Yeah.
Because we are teaching them by not explicitly teaching them that we are implicitly the hidden curriculum in parenting in this country at this moment in time is if you're not going to stick with it, if you're not going to give it your all, if you're not going to do all the things, if you're not going to show grit, oh my God, can we retire that word? If you are not going to do it, then don't do it.
Yeah.
But if you're going to do it, you better be the best. And I will hire you every coach and I will hire you. Right. And I'm not dogging. I'm not, I swear to God, I'm not dogging. Finding things you're passionate about and becoming good at them, right? And and all glory to those of us who can, who are well enough resourced that we can provide the little bit of extra, right, for those passions. But somewhere along the line,
it got fucked up.
It got toxic. It got harmful. It crossed into this place where no one is allowed to play really bad softball. Right? So, you know, I mean, thinking about sports culture, and I often joke that I don't sport. And the reality is, I'm actually not a terrible athlete. You know, I'm a really good rock climber, or I was back, you know, in my 20s and 30s. And there are a lot of things I've done in my life, that physical things that I did that I was good at. And, right, growing up in the 70s, and 80s, those glory years, you know, in a small town, my summer sport was softball, right? And here's what it looked like. It was a rec league. mom tried to remember to sign me up every year. I would grab my bat and my glove and ride my bike to the local park twice a week. We would hope that the coach would show up. We would hope that the coach wouldn't be drunk when they showed up. We'd practice for a couple of hours, right? Well, he hollered at us from the sidelines. And yeah. then, and it was the same group of girls because we all lived in the same area and we were two grades, right? Because that's how it was set up. So we were either the youngest or the oldest. Mm-hmm. And then on Saturday, mom would drive me to the ball field across town and sit there with a book. And, you know, if I did something spectacular, she might look up and go, and then we move on. And it was fucking glorious.
Yeah.
I played pitcher.
Fun.
I played catcher. I played first base. I played right field. I played, you know, all of it.
Rode the pine.
Poorly at best. Right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And it was so much fun. It was so much fun. Now, again, I'm not dogging competition, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm pointing to a gap.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pointing to a gap. I am not, I really, because I know I start saying this and there's going to be a whole army of mamas with pitchforks lined up to burn me in effigy because I am suggesting that a second grader who has chosen his sport and chosen his position on that sports team and has a private coach for it is somehow bad. I'm not saying that.
Mm.
I'm saying, where is the space for? Mm-hmm. And I'm also saying that the data do suggest that repetitive sports injuries are on the rise because of, right? We evolved. Again, going back to how we evolved.
Specializing.
Right. We evolved to do all the things and move in all the ways until such time as our bodies physically developed enough to begin to specialize, right? The fact that we're seeing sports injuries, you know, orthopedic sports injuries that we didn't used to see until like pro ball in teenagers, I think is a harbinger. It's a, you know, it's the canary in the coal mine.
Indicator. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the bigger challenge I see and the thing I worry about, we're all out there lamenting adolescent mental health. Mm. We're wringing our hands, even as we buy them iPhones at age 7, we are wringing our hands collectively. Again, we are wringing our hands about social media without remembering that at the end of the day, she who pays the bills gets to control where people who aren't paying the bills go in social media land. So for anybody whose kids are convincing them that everybody has social media, none of my kids do. My kids don't get iPhones until they are 8th grade, right? 13 years old. And the social media thing was a rule all the way through high school. I raised my first two boys never had social media. My younger two will not have social media while they live. And you know what? Wow. They were actually well-adjusted, fine. Lots of friends, did all the things. So, you know, that's a kid myth. Now, COVID made it harder. I'm going to acknowledge COVID made everything harder. The point that I'm driving at here though, and I went off on a tangent, is we keep pointing to that, like social media is the problem. Like social media is somehow the thing that if we could fix it, then our kids wouldn't be having the, we wouldn't be seeing the adolescent mental health crisis that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. What I'm finding myself really curious about is, well, what do we think is the, when we say we have an adolescent mental health crisis, what is it actually that we're seeing? Right? We're seeing the tail end, right? Depression and profound anxiety and, you know, sort of the pathology that requires intervention. That's what we're pointing to. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I'm really interested in is, what are the stressors, right? Mm-hmm. Or what are they lacking in terms of resourcing that is mm-hmm. pushing towards this greater anxiety and depression? Mm-hmm. Because we have a generation of children who are being brought up with way, way, way too much trauma, primary, mm-hmm. secondary, vicarious, right? Mm-hmm. And not enough of some things that would allow them to navigate it mm-hmm. more healthfully, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, connection mitigates trauma. That is our catchphrase at Lodestar. That mm-hmm. is an absolute truth. Where are we disrupting their natural tendencies to connect? Mm-hmm. Where is that process being short-circuited or mm-hmm. Injured, right? Mm-hmm. Their ability to connect with us, their ability to form connections with each other. I don't think mm-hmm. it's just social media. Mm-hmm. I also think, right, when we start talking about resilience, mm-hmm. which is a word that's getting weaponized an awful lot, mm-hmm. and we say, well, we got to build resilience in our kids. Okay, you know what the best way to make sure somebody feels internally robust? Mm-hmm. Tell them to go be bad at a lot of things and let their ego find out it can survive it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes,
let the ego develop, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, stress is good. Let the ego mm-hmm. develop the capacity to be bad at things and take joy in being bad at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think? I'm just thinking, you know, with you talking, like, so many of these kids are in, like, after school, they're at school all day, and then they immediately go to these after school activities, sports, that type of thing, where, you know, they're there for hours, multiple days a week, and then weekends, like, you know, we used to travel to Dayton, which is, you're not from Ohio, but, you know, like,
oh, I know where it is. I'm from Illinois, so I know what you're talking about.
So, you know, there isn't a lot of time to connect as a family. Most families are, yep. both parents are working, and by the time dinner rolls around with sports and that type of thing, we were lucky to all be eating at the same table. So I think it's connected for sure. Like, this race to nowhere that we're putting our kids on.
I wasn't going to say it because it sounds insulting, but since you brought it in, it's the super highway to nowhere.
Yeah, and we're all
super
on
highway
it.
To nowhere, and we're opting in. Right. And so the question then becomes, do we see what we're opting into? Mm-hmm. Right. We have been sold a bill of goods. This is all fear based.
Yeah.
Look, fear is a sneaky little bitch. She is nothing but a thief.
She thief is nothing joy. But a thief. Yeah, for sure.
But fear will convince you that a lie is the truth. Mm-hmm. And that if you believe that lie, you will somehow be safe. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, right? Stay with me here. In this particular case, coming full circle to your client, what are we trying to keep safe? We're trying to keep our children mm-hmm. safe. So we have bought into this collective lie that the only success that we can assure for our children, mm-hmm. right? Because we want our children to be successful. Mm-hmm. And we have a very narrow definition of success in America. And that crosses educational demographics, economic demographics. It's a very narrow definition. It means, and it's getting narrower. And that's the thing that really terrifies me, mm-hmm. right? It's not just a four-year degree followed by a graduate. It is a four-year degree at one of 10 schools. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Possibly five, depending on who you are, right? And the path into those schools is narrowing every day, mm-hmm. right? And. Mm-hmm. And so we become hyper competitive on behalf of our children. Mm-hmm. And it shows up in a lot of insidious ways. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, I saw some advertisement. I don't, I don't watch television, but I saw some advertisement about like a cheerleader mom killing another cheerleader or something like that. And I was like, what the hell? Right. But it's that kind of thing. So I'm not talking about that even so much as what are the messages, slow, repeated messages we are giving our children over time that says, implicitly or explicitly, I think most of it is implicit, that says, that's the goal. And so let me curate every moment of your life in pursuit of that goal because I love you. It's not done out of hate. I hate you, so I'm going to do this. No, it's done out of love. And it's done out of only the type of fear that love can instill.
Yeah. I mean,
that's a different kind of fear, right? That's the fear that has us standing next to their cribs to make sure they're breathing all night long.
Oh, God, fuck
only
me.
Love can instill fear like that.
Yeah, or having them so monitored that they're like on six different cameras and they've got a little SAO2 monitor on their foot that alarms in the middle of the night and makes you think your child's dead in the middle of the night. I mean, talk about traumatic, like, I'm going off on a tangent, but yeah, thinking about.
No, it's a good point though, because we're normalizing these things. We're normalizing this hyper observed, hyper connected, hyper competitive, accelerated. Like our kids get one childhood. One childhood. So I, for anybody who needs it, it is okay to tap out.
Yeah.
We jumped off the super highway to nowhere when my son, Joseph, my eldest son, who is now graduated from college, off doing the things, right? When he was in the second grade. And some of it was, I recognized it. And some of it was, I am not. Are you kidding me? I got my own life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I am not sitting and watching four baseball games with a bunch of kids who can't, I don't want to watch this shit. Even if you were good at it, I don't want to watch it.
Oh my God.
So some of it was born of that.
Yeah.
Some of it was born of the reality of our lives. And then some of it was also born now that I'm saying this out loud, some of it's born from privilege, right? But I have the privilege of understanding and believing that I can extend my children's childhood and let them fail and figure it out. I don't have that added burden of if they don't get it right, everything crumbles, right? And there are parents who
are
living
with
that fear,
yeah.
Right? So there's some I want to say there's some earned and unearned privilege baked into that statement. But the bigger part of it, though, I think is we can choose to not be on the superhighway to nowhere anymore. And it's such a lie. So Joseph, right? First one going off to college. This was in, I should know when he graduated. I can't remember now. 2019. I think 2018, 2019 from high school. So, you know, been a long, long, long time. He knew he wanted a smaller liberal arts college. That's fine, right? We did not do the thing that everybody does as a junior in high school, right? Which is go look at all the colleges and, you know, do that. I was like, why am I going to take you somewhere if you're not in? That's stupid.
Yeah.
I'm not for everybody. I was like, I'll take you to a big school. I'll take you to a small school. You look at them, you decide what type of school you want. Then you do your research.
Yeah.
You send off your applications. Once you're accepted, we'll go look.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's how we did
it. Yeah, love it.
For anybody who wants a different path, that's how we did it. Did it that same way with my second son. Here's the thing that's interesting though. So Joseph was was academically a stronger student in high school than my second son, Jacob. Jacob graduated in the middle of COVID on top of it. And Joseph just had a lot more like extracurricular stuff. None of it sports, although he was really bad at a lot of things, including tennis. But he did a lot of other things, right, that he was able to do. So when he narrowed his list down, he had some really, really well-known top 10 schools that he got into. Mm-hmm. And he ultimately ended up picking Middlebury, okay, which was the perfect school for him, yeah, right? Most people have never even heard of it. That's fine. It's a little tiny liberal arts school in Vermont.
I knew that. I was going to say I knew that, but I don't know how.
Yeah. great school, but in that, whatever that US world ranking, you know, the elite.
Yeah.
Okay. So in all of this time, as we're going through this with Joseph, at no point in time did any school, now we don't qualify for financial aid. Right. So obviously that's a non-starter, but no school that he was applying to was offering scholarships to him. Mm-hmm. Right. So come along with Jacob now. Right. He also, we did the same thing.
Yeah.
Went and looked at some big schools, some small schools. He's like, nope, I want a small. He is my farm boy, by the way. So it. I want to stay in the Midwest. I want something small. So he starts applying now, right? He's got a couple of reach schools because my belief is if you're not getting rejected, you're not trying.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're not failing,
if you're not getting rejected, you're not trying, right? So he had a couple, right? And then he had, but overall, like, the reach schools for Jacob were probably more of a, like a, I'm going to get in here kind of school for Joseph. Yeah. And then Jacob was like next tier down. So top 20 to 30% of schools ranking. $850,000 in total in scholarships offered to him across 12 different schools.
Wow.
Or 14 schools that he got accepted to. Now, I didn't know this was a thing, first of all, because he wasn't applying for scholarships.
Yeah.
But he applied to these schools and they're like, oh, yes. And based on, we will also give you this money to come here.
Yeah, amazing.
One tier down.
Yeah.
One tier down.
Hmm.
Now, is he getting a less than education than just, absolutely, he's at Denison, right? You know, Denison in Ohio.
Yeah, that's right in our backyard.
So, good. So I'll send him to you next time he's acting
that works.
So he needs it, getting a fabulous education.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But you see what I'm driving at here.
Oh yeah.
Right. We have, who's telling us this as parents, who's having these conversations and saying, chill out.
Yeah.
There are a lot of ways for our children to figure out. And frankly, my last two may decide not to go to college at all. I got one who just rebuilt a truck. He's 13 years old. He's in the process of rebuilding a truck that he swindled out of a farmer. It was out in the middle of a farm field. He comes home. He's like, hey, mama, I had my truck on that, my eye on that truck for a while. I'm like, you are 13. What do you mean you had your abandoned truck out in the middle of a field? Right. And he says, well, I saw the farmer out there today. So I went and I offered him $500 for it. And he told me if I could get it out, I could have it.
It's amazing.
It's running. It now has brakes. He rebuilt the front, the bench front. It's got like a billion miles on it. He rebuilt the front seat and then he sewed the thing to go on the front seat, right? Okay. Go be bad at things.
Yeah.
Go be bad at a lot of things.
That's amazing.
You know?
That's so amazing.
There are so many ways. Mm-hmm. Now, what does this have to do with anything? The more we narrow, I think the less sturdy we are.
Yeah, it makes sense.
We become sturdier. I don't even want to use the word resilient. We become sturdier. When we are expanding our capacity to problem solved, figure things out, when we're given permission to go figure it out.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I have some like flexes from when my kids were younger. Like, I don't know if you remember at one point I was going to, like meet the teacher night and they had this program. I don't even remember the name of it but it was basically so that I could receive all the text messages about my children's assignments and tests and that type of thing.
Is it called the program from hell? I graduated from elementary school.
I said, I raised my hand and I was like, how do we opt out of this? Because I don't want like, I already took history and I already took this science. Like, and the teacher was like, I think you might be the first person to ever ask me that. I'm like, yes, I am opting out. Like,
would you like me to give you another one?
Yeah, do it.
So I love this. And really, y'all, just for your listeners, like, I'm offering these stories not because I'm cool, because I'm really not, and I'm not very well liked sometimes. I'm offering these stories because nobody ever tells us these things. Yeah,
my clients hear this all the time. Chill the fuck out. Calm the fuck down.
What I hope is that by hearing that some mama did this, mm-hmm. and it's okay, and the kids are all right, mm-hmm. that maybe it gives you permission to explore a little mm-hmm. bit, to let go of a little bit of fear and experiment with maybe giving kids a little bit more
leeway,
oxygen,
yeah,
to be bad. Mm-hmm. So listen, here's the thing. I come from a family of educators, right? There are a few things that I think are more valuable than good education.
Same.
And education is very expansive to me. So I am not dogging education, right? I am all about education. I'm also the daughter of an immigrant. Of course, I'm all about education, right? If we want to just go ahead and go down that path. And when we start looking at best elementary, middle school, high school educational data, mm-hmm. not practices, mm-hmm. the actual data, mm-hmm. one of the first things you will find out is that homework is bullshit.
Oh yeah. Preaching to the choir.
Homework is bullshit. It does absolutely nothing to enhance or improve learning. Mm-hmm. It does absolutely nothing to reinforce whatever lesson was taught that day. Mm-hmm. It does nothing.
Yeah.
There are no benefits and enormous detriment mm-hmm. to homework, especially non-specific homework, meaning that it's not attached to a very carefully, thoughtfully curated project mm-hmm. prior to high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Don't believe me. Go to Dr. Google. He'll give you all the data on this. All right. So I know this going in. So we're in a very good and, sought public school.
Yeah, us too.
Big believer in the public education system.
Same.
Public school system. And one of the things that I started, why is my kindergartner coming home with homework? Why is my first grader second? So, Joseph, firstborn, go in, having the conversations with the teachers. They're like, well, it's expected mm-hmm. in a district of this type that the children have homework so that, right? Mm-hmm. So what does that tell me? That tells me that an educational decision is being put in place, not in the interest of the child, mm-hmm. but to shut the parents up.
Who are like, my kid because needs to have homework.
Because it is the expectation, because the parents don't know better, mm-hmm. right? Because what is our internalized process is that if we're not striving, we're useless, mm-hmm. right? So somewhere about halfway through kindergarten year with Joseph, with my oldest, I went back and talked to his kindergarten teacher and she's like, well, he's not turning in his homework. I said, oh yeah, that's because I throw it away every night.
I told you she was a badass, people. She scoffed at it. It's true.
I throw it away. And the next year, when I first went to meet the teacher night with the first grade, I said, listen, I love you. I love teachers. You are my favorite people in the world. Please do not take this as insulting or lack of current concern or care. But you and I both know that homework is bullshit. And so when my kid does not bring back his homework, please know it is that when you send it home, with all love and respect, I am taking it out of his backpack and throwing it in the trash
mm-hmm.
every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we are going to do instead is he's just been here for 8-9 hours.
Right.
He's six.
Yeah. We're going to play.
We're going to play. We're going to read. We're going to sit down and have dinner at probably 6 o'clock. And at 7 o'clock, he's going to be heading
exhausted,
to bed.
Yeah.
And he's going to be asleep by 7:30 because he's six and he needs 10 hours of sleep still.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing.
And the teachers would kind of look at me. Now I developed a reputation pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not for everyone. So they, I think they, some of them who agreed
yeah.
would like deliberately take my kids, and others were like, just leave, leave this rough woman out of my classroom. But all of my kids, this has been the rule.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do kids need? They need to hear you reading to them. Mm-hmm. And you want the bonus? They need to see you reading for fun on your own.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love to read. So
and your husband or your spouse or your partner, right? Mm-hmm. They also need to see men in my family. Mm-hmm. They need to see men reading for fun and pleasure on their own, not just reading to them.
Yeah. So
that actually has been shown to have some benefits long term.
I love
homework.
It. Not so much.
Fuck it.
Fuck it.
Set it on fire, throw it away. Tell the truth.
Yeah.
So your kid doesn't get in trouble. I mean, at least, you know,
right.
own
it. Exactly. Yeah. I will
I'm
say
the problem. It's me.
Both of the boys. Yeah. Both of the boys did have multiple teachers who were on the no homework train. And, you know, this was before I had found coaching and before I knew that we were on a race to nowhere. And I was like, wow, like no homework at all. Okay. You know, and I kept telling Owen, at some point it's going to get harder, buddy. You're going to have to like work harder and that type of thing. And he finally, as a freshman in college this year, is like, Mom, calculus is hard. I'm like, yes, yes, it
good.
Is.
Good. Oh, I'm excited for him that it's hard.
Yeah.
That means that he's catching up with his native abilities. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah. So good.
That's awesome. Go do the hard shit. I'll take a hard C over an easy A every day.
Yeah. God, what if that was the message though? God, that would be so revolutionary.
Yeah, but why isn't it?
Right. I know. I'm agreeing with
it's
you.
It's our message.
Yeah.
It's our message.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. True, true, yeah. true. Yeah.
But you know, I mean, I mean that in the most generous sense. Mm-hmm. Like, we're the goddamn parents.
Yeah, that's true. True. You got me. Got me about
we got to start. This has got to be the message that we're sharing along with the message that, you know, yes, there's so much yes and in this. Mm-hmm. Yes, we can do all of it and we can continue to strive for excellence. Mm-hmm. It is more that look, we're seeing how it's impacted us. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the price. Mm-hmm. You and I are seeing the price every day.
Yeah.
I see the price every time I step into, you know, we go, we do these 3-day leadership intensives for these enormous organizations. And I see and hear and feel the price mm-hmm. that they are, have, and continue to pay. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be a price. I'm not suggesting there shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I'm suggesting that somewhere along the way, we started putting the price off on our kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We started asking them to pay. And the price they're paying is their childhood. Yeah. The price they're paying is the opportunity to learn what it is to be bored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And set a fire, mm-hmm. build a fire and set a fire and play with a knife.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And fall out of a tree mm-hmm. and get lost. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They don't even have the and opportunity to get lost anymore.
No, there's, you know, there's some great research around that too. Right. Like, in the 90s, I can't remember who was the data scientist who collected this, but he went back in time and tried to like piece together what was a child's radius in the 1950s, which was approximately 5 miles
wow.
or, you know, then what happened over the decades, mm-hmm. right? So in the 70s, it had shrunk to about 2.5. That's still pretty decent, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what else happened in the 70s and or early 80s, right, was a couple of really high profile kidnappings.
Yeah, Adam. Never
exactly.
forget it. Yeah.
And on the, right? And so all of a sudden, everybody in the country was very afraid of the paper dragon. Mm-hmm. Your kid's going to be kidnapped by a stranger, mm-hmm. and not at all aware of the real dragon, mm-hmm. which is your children's development is stunted by the fact that you are watching them every second
constantly,
of the day.
Yeah.
Right. Or protecting them or bubble wrapping mm-hmm. them. So that's the real danger.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the circumference started to shrink. And yeah. that was the word I was looking for. Started yeah. to shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink. And the last data point I saw, because I was using this for the development of some public health programs in 2008, 2009, was that by the late 90s, early aughts, it had shrunk to 20 feet.
Oh, for the love of God.
20 feet. And that within those 20 feet, 90% of children are observed at all times, meaning that parental eyes are on them.
Mm, wow. No bueno. And I mean, I think what my observation has been, and you may disagree, but the more that we hear through the global and 24-hour news cycle, like we're hearing all these terrible things that are happening to people. And not to say that they're not happening, but I think that in some way, shape, or form, terrible things have been happening forever, but we just didn't necessarily hear about it immediately and over a 24-hour news cycle. Yeah. So again, like trying to talk people out of being fearful of something that they've been made to be afraid of is so, it's nearly impossible to do.
Yeah. Well, our nervous systems don't ever rest. Mm-hmm. So, you know, coming back to this, the very opening, yeah. right? To be immersed in suffering and loss mm-hmm. and not be impacted, mm-hmm. right? Well, I think the same is true when we just take it out of the medical profession and look at the human profession, mm-hmm. right? We are immersed in suffering and loss and harm and fear. And the question becomes, what is the price?
Mm-hmm.
Now, my ethic says that I will bear witness. And I also know and understand that there are places I can titrate my dose. Mm-hmm. I can titrate my dose of news. Mm-hmm. I can titrate my dose of social media
consumption,
you know,
yeah.
doom scroll.
Yeah.
I can titrate my dose. That's that I have choice in that.
Mm-hmm.
I can also, begin to ask myself about these fears,
mm-hmm.
right, that are sort of coming up. And is it, it may be a real fear.
Mm-hmm.
How probable a fear
right.
is it? Right. So those are, that's a, right.
Yeah.
So, It may be something that's very real, but has a, you know, 0.0001 probability. Well, is it worth stunting
yeah.
my child's development
right.
for a 0.001 probability,
right.
no matter how real the fear may
yeah.
be? So everything, there is no safe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe if we just start with that, safety's an illusion.
Right. True.
Safety's an illusion, y'all. I hate to think that I'm the first person who ever taught you that.
Yeah.
But safety is not real. It is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Now we live with that illusion because we do.
Yeah.
We'd all be under the bed sucking our thumb, right? Safety is an illusion.
Yeah.
So when we can say, okay, safety is an illusion, and therefore I get to choose about what allows me to feel more safe, allows me to feel my children are more safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's helpful. But being immersed in all of this, what does it do? Well, it primes the pump.
Mm-hmm. Well,
right?
I mean,
so when we're absorbing this all the time,
mm-hmm.
that system becomes primed.
Mm-hmm.
And the system that's scanning in the background for a face-eating bear
mm-hmm.
can very easily hear a sound, react as if it's a face eating bear. And then I turn around. It's a chipmunk.
Right.
Y'all. Right. But I'm already gone. I'm already off to the races.
Yeah. 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 My God, we could talk forever. Couldn't we?
I think we just did. I'm so over time. I'm sure.
I want to say one more thing though, cause I think it's like, it's making me think about like the, mental health crisis with kids. Like they are exposed to this 24-hour news cycle and exposed to, like, I mean, my young adult children are almost in like doomsday, like, because they believe that the planet isn't going to be here for them when they're my age. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. I certainly believe in climate change and, you know, that humans have a role to play in it. But like, I think that, you know, they just, I sense a sense of like helplessness, hopelessness that I don't know how to mitigate, you know. It's like, other than to say like safety is an illusion and it always has been. And, you know, I mean, I don't know that
the danger is going to come from where you least expect it. Right. Yeah. I mean, we put up all of these safeguards, and your listeners don't know this, but you do, right? My oldest son, when he was 13, I diagnosed him with leukemia, mm-hmm. right? So you do all of the things, mm-hmm. you make the homemade baby food, mm-hmm. you do the thing, you know, you prevent. And then the fucking danger crawls out of their bone marrow.
Yeah. Fuck. Leukemia.
Right. So the danger isn't in just as fine as, you know, yes. and I want everybody else to know. And right. The danger is rarely exactly where we think it mm-hmm. is, especially these sort of existential dangers. Right. The question becomes, how do we live fully in love with this one life? Mm-hmm. What does that look like for you? What does that look like for your children? Mm-hmm. In our family, that meant really choosing to opt out of the superhighway mm-hmm. to nowhere, mm-hmm. right? And so it's going to mean different things to everyone. Yeah. Maybe it's opting out of some portions of mm-hmm. it. That's great. Mm-hmm. What matters to you, mm-hmm. to you mm-hmm. and to your family and your children, not what does fear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the problem with fear is it always sides with the thing we're most afraid of.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how it wins. Mm-hmm. And so I think we just get to be more and more honest with each other. There's no one right way to do this. Mm-hmm. Right? But I do think that the exposure matters. Mm-hmm. And so particularly with our kids, when we're allowing their very high dose exposure to all of this toxic stress, mm-hmm. right? And we aren't giving them enough of what they need, mm-hmm. including things like rest and places to fail and see that that's mm-hmm. not the end, and places to be bad at things, and right? And also just basic developmental things, mm-hmm. right? Like learning to navigate danger. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to be doing that from the time they're tiny.
Yeah.
Right. What are the dangers every child is supposed to learn to navigate? Going too fast, getting lost, playing with sharp objects, playing with fire, right? And climbing to great heights.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't forget drowning.
Yeah, well, we're gonna set that one over here. But those five things, they are absolutely supposed to learn how to actively navigate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if we never allow them to use a real knife to cut mm-hmm, the carrots,
mm-hmm. yeah, they're never
because
learn.
We're afraid of a nick.
Mm-hmm.
Then I will tell you, they come to my house to babysit as high schoolers, and they don't know how to cut up an apple. And I'm like, well, I can't leave you in charge.
That's amazing.
Girl, I got a story for everything.
I know you do. Okay. Tell my listeners, if they want to learn more about you, if they're physicians, if they're physician coaches, if they want to know more about Lodestar, like, how do people find you?
Lodestar, LodestarPC.com.
Okay.
LodestarPC.com.
I love it. And your stuff is all over that. And I have a feeling that people are going to love this podcast, and I have a feeling we're going to have a record.
Or hate it. There'll be some who hate it. Let's just own that right out of the gate.
They're fine. They can scroll on and listen to somebody else.
Okay. I'm not for everybody.
Me neither. Okay. But like I said, we could talk forever. So we'll see. I'll ask them if they want other stories, other help and that type of thing. And I would love to have you back on at some point if you're up for that.
always. It was so lovely spending time with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, same, same, girl. Same, same, same.
Same, same, same. All right. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, you're
Thanks
so
for
welcome.
Creating this.
You're so welcome. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Bye, guys. We'll see you next week. Hey, everybody. Don't go quite yet. I want to let you know all the ways that you can work with me. If you've been listening to this podcast, and maybe especially you have listened to the episodes where I interview my clients, and you are thinking, like the older woman in the diner in the classic Meg Ryan, Billy Crystal film, When Harry Met Sally. In the film, Sally is proving a point to Harry by faking an orgasm while in public at a diner. Sally finishes, so to speak, and then takes a bite of her food. The older woman in the next booth says, "I'll have what she's having." If you've been thinking, "I'll have what she's having," this is your sign from the universe to schedule a consult with me. I have a few spots available for one-on-one coaching with me. This is a space where I am laser focused on you and your brain for 6 months at a time. I will also be doing consults with women who want to join my next group coaching cohort, which will likely start in the spring of 2024. The way to contact me is to go to my website, melissaparsonscoaching.com, go to the Work With Me page, and click Book Now to schedule your consult. I will look forward to hearing from you. Let's make 2024 your favorite year ever as you become your favorite you.